Hi, and welcome to Forest of the Futures, the podcast series where we talk about innovation, trends, and grand ideas in the world of sustainable forestry, climate mitigation, and of course, FSC. I have been looking forward to today, because today we are going to talk about the real impact of FSC on the ground on wildlife and biodiversity. Because a new study was recently revealed in Nature magazine on just that. It was the largest of its kind, and I am fortunate enough to have the lead scientist behind the research explain me much more about it. His name is Yuri Swerts, and he works at University of Utrecht. He spent 5 years gathering data in Congo, Cameroon, and Gabon in an attempt to test FSC's core promise that we protect biodiversity and wildlife. He wanted to see whether that can also be measured in the forest. This is at the core of what we do in FSC and what we're hoping and counting on being part of our contribution to the world. And when Yuri gave a sneak peek of his results at our General Assembly back in 2022, his presentation was so impactful that some of my colleagues left the room with tears in their eyes. I am hoping that I get some of that same feeling in my stomach after today's interview. So with that, why don't we just dive right in? Hi, Yuri. I've been teasing in the intro about your study, but maybe we can just start by the conclusion. Can you tell us what the effect of FSC certification is on the ground?
Hi, Loa. Yes. Well, I looked at wildlife in tropical forests. Well, I can safely say that FSC really benefits the wildlife in these tropical forests. We showed that FSC certified forests have 2.7 times more animals in logging concessions than non-certified forests. And especially the larger species, so elephants, gorillas, chimpanzees, they are way more abundant in tropical forests that are FSC certified.
Did you focus solely on animals?
I only focused on wildlife, and that's because they're a very vulnerable part of the ecosystem, because large mammals, if they get in touch with humans, tend to get hunted out, and then their populations decrease. So if you can prove that a system manages these populations well, so that they don't decline, then you can show that the system is, well, effectively managing a large part of its biodiversity. Of its vulnerable biodiversity.
Yeah. Okay. So if the big animals thrive, then the ecosystem as such thrives.
Well, of course, there are other aspects to the ecosystem, like tree diversity. And you can even look at lichens and mosses and everything and things that I didn't look at. But for mammals and for wildlife, yes, large mammals are a good indicator of a healthy ecosystem.
And how did you reach the conclusion? What does that actually take?
Well, it takes 5 years of field work and a lot of collaborations with people, companies, countries, NGOs to set it all up. But you also have to go into the forest. We installed 474 camera traps and 14 different logging concessions. They yielded us 1.3 million camera trap photos. We had to look at all those photos, annotate them, so we had to identify the species on all those photos. Then we had to do the analysis and write an article. So that's what it takes.
It sounds like a lot of work. Did you look at all of those photos, like one by one?
Yeah, we did. Luckily, I had a lot of students that were sitting at home during the COVID pandemic. So normally these students go out into nature, but they weren't allowed to. So, well, we gave them projects with camera trap photos, and they had to, identify those photos, which gave them nice projects.
So you can't go into the forest, but you can look at photos. Wow. How do you set up that menu? How many camera traps was it? 400 and something?
474, yeah.
474. So how do you set those up?
So that takes quite some protocols, because if you set up a camera trap, then you don't want it to always be looking at a path in the forest, for example, because some animals use those paths while others don't. For example, the larger animals, elephants and leopards, they use those paths a lot, but pangolins might not. So you would get a skewed representation of the wildlife in that forest. So you want to have a totally random placement of camera traps. So what we did before going into the forest, I selected sites that were comparable between an FSC concession and a non-FSC concession in terms of drivers of animal abundance. So for example, distance to roads, distance to rivers, distance to cities, all those things that can drive decline or the growth of animal populations. And then if we identified those locations, I set up a grid of camera traps for which we went into the forest. And then we went to those locations. And then if we reached those locations, then we had to find the first spot, the nearest spot to that location with at least 4 meters visibility. And then we installed the camera trap. So that way you get a random representation of the wildlife in the forest.
Wow. I've heard a scientist say that he couldn't have endured what you did during those field trips. That makes me really curious. What is the difficult part of that? I guess you just touched upon some of that, but what is it that it takes?
Getting everything started was the first thing. So first I had to get the collaborations going with the logging companies. So they were not too interested in collaborating at first because they were like, okay, another researcher that wants to do stuff that's not our core business. I understand that. But I approached all the FSC certified companies in the study region. So in Congo, Gabon, and Cameroon. And all of them wanted to cooperate except for one, unfortunately. Then I had to find non-FSC certified companies that were near to these companies so that I had local comparisons between an FSC and a non-FSC certified company. Well, getting all that started is one thing, but then I needed the funds as well for this research because I didn't have the money to buy camera traps and to hire people to go into the field. So I had to write research proposals and get the money together to do this research. We had to go into the forest. That's the second level. So yeah, you have to go into a village. You have to ask, hey, who wants to work with me and go into the forest to install these camera traps, set up a new team, set up a camp every night, walk through the forest for 8 days, install camera traps every day, find water every evening to set up a new camp, break down the camp in the morning. And so that's quite tough. And then the third level is the data analysis. That's also quite a tough bit of all this. And that's part of it is looking at the 1.3 million camera trap images. But then there was also quite some sophisticated statistics that were required to analyze the data.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you also have to be able to, one thing is saying, is there an animal on this particular image? But you also then have to identify which animal it is.
If you spot a leopard and you spot it again 5 minutes later, you can't really say like, hey, that's two animals, right? So you have to incorporate that in the data analysis because you need a buffer between observations of the same species within a certain time buffer. Otherwise, you count them double. So that's quite difficult to code. Those are things you have to take into account.
How long did it take from you conceiving this whole idea that you wanted to do this and then until the first time you were in the actual forest?
I wrote a research proposal in 2016 and I got the money for my PhD because it was my PhD project. Then that started in 2017. So then we had to go into Cameroon and talk to logging companies, WWF and other NGOs that wanted to get involved. And we had to get the funds. And in the end, the first real data was being gathered in 2018. So it took about 1.5, 2 years. Yeah.
Wow. That does take some stamina. And if you then look at all of those field trips, I imagine there was some amazing trips, some of those. What was the most surprising that you experienced during those field studies?
The most surprising for me was that bees, like honeybees, can be very smart and annoying and dangerous because if bees find your camp before the night falls, then they can be there with like a couple of bees and get on your clothes and on your tent to lick the minerals off. Uh-huh. But then you already know like, okay, next morning we have to break the camp before the sun rises. So we have to break it like 4 o'clock in the morning to leave before the bees come back. Because bees, they go back to their colony when it's dark, but they have a collective memory. And then they come back, like thousands of them, to find the minerals on your clothes and on your body and everything. So then it makes it very difficult to break a camp and to make breakfast and everything. So if there were bees in the evening, sometimes just a couple, then we knew like, okay, we have to get our headlights on in the morning, 3:30, wake up and leave because otherwise we get stung like 20, 30 times. So that was quite an eye opener to me.
Wow. And how did you get that learning? Was that something that the locals knew or is that something that you learned the hard way?
Well, I learned a lot from the locals. They were aware of the bees. But at the same time, also learned it the hard way. When you get stung 20 times, the next time, you know. So, yeah.
How long did it actually take for you to be able to see, there is a difference between the FSC-certified forest and non-certified forest? Could you tell already on the ground?
On the ground, yes. Sometimes it was quite clear, actually, because elephants, they make quite clear paths. Well, when these paths were absent, then we would already know that there would be a lot less elephants, right? And also when collecting camera traps, sometimes we were in concessions where we lost a lot of camera traps because of elephants, because, well, they can be quite curious. Sometimes they smell or touch a camera trap and then they easily break it. So if no camera traps would be broken, we'd also know that, okay, there are probably not a lot of elephants. Well, in some of the concessions, we found a lot of broken camera traps, and it was clear that it was not done by humans. A lot of elephant steps next to it and things like that. So those were indications that, you can see that the forest alone harbored more animals. But yeah, you can see it also from other types of trails and from nests and things like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I would assume when you said you lost a lot of camera traps, I would have assumed that that was in the non-certified, that it was because the poachers would have potentially taken them away.
Yeah, sometimes that happened as well. But our sites were quite far away from villages. So even though hunting can still have a big effect on wildlife populations, of course, yeah, it wasn't like a lot of people would be there and steal camera traps. Yeah.
The lack of elephants, is that the biggest difference between the certified and non-certified forest areas? Or,
well, for all species larger than 10 kilograms, we actually show a very large difference in their abundance between FSC and non-FSC sites. So that accounts for, well, the chimps, but also for forest duikers, like forest antelopes and other larger species. That are regularly hunted and that recover more slowly from hunting because they're larger, the gestation periods are slower. So yes, It's not just the elephants.
I'm glad. Can you then also tell from the study why there's such a big difference? Is it the hunting that's the primary difference?
Yeah, that's what I assume it to be. And that's what it logically is, because for selective logging in tropical forests, you need to make roads. So you create a lot of access into the forest. And without these roads, it's very difficult to go into the forest because, you just have to cut lianas and, you walk really slowly. Have you ever been in a tropical forest?
I have, yes. Not much, though.
But did you walk on a trail or did you...
No, it was actually, it was a forest. I've been a couple of times, but every time it's been with logging companies, so it's been in logging roads, but also been shown the closed roads afterwards, etc.
Yeah, exactly. Without these roads, you can just walk 10 kilometers a day and not much further. But with roads, you get to take a motorbike and just drive through the concession. And those roads are everywhere, right? Because you need to take trees from everywhere. Mm. So then it's very easy to hunt everywhere. And the populations, the wildlife populations, can't sustain that pressure. But then in FSC certified concessions, they make sure that those roads are closed. And they also make sure that people aren't allowed to hunt because they check for hunting gear. And they also provide alternative protein through supermarkets in the logging camps and things. So there's less need to hunt. So yes, I think it's mostly the hunting for the large mammals that makes a difference.
Yeah. Was this what you expected when going in? Is this the thesis that you had when starting this?
Yeah, so that's what the thesis was. And that was pretty easy for us as well, because that's what FSC claimed to do, right? And we went out to test whether the claim was correct.
Mm-hmm. What was then the, if you were to say, the most surprising conclusion from your study? What did you conclude that you didn't expect, if anything?
Yeah, well, I was actually quite surprised about the strong effect for elephants. Elephants are heavily poached. 90% of their population went down in the last decades. And forest elephants is what we're talking about, by the way. So there are different species than savannah elephants in Africa. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to protect them because in a forest, you don't have the overview, you don't have the clear visibility that you have on the savannah. So poachers can easily hide. So I was actually surprised to see that FSC is so effective in protecting them. Apart from the effects of protection, there can be another thing at play here, namely that elephants are very intelligent. They might also know that FSC certified concessions are safer to them because they communicate with other elephants and they're very smart. So there's been this other study some years ago where they colored elephants with GPS colors to measure where they went and how fast they ran. And none of the colored elephants ever crossed an unsafe road. So that's a road outside of a protected area, for example, except for one. And that elephant ran like 9 times or 10 times. I'm not sure if I quoted correctly, but Well, a lot faster than her normal pace. And that's when she crossed that unsafe road. So she was fully aware that it was unsafe. I can imagine, and this is, of course, just a hypothesis, they also know that FSC certified concessions are safe to them, and that might create a sink of for elephants.
But how would they know where the barrier is for that certified and non-certified? I guess they wouldn't.
Well, I guess they don't, but they probably communicate, or family member got shot here and there, you know, and they probably know that. But now I'm just speculating, of course.
Do they live in families, or how do they live, elephants? Are they in big tribes or?
Females with their families, and then you have the individual bulls roaming the forest. So. Mm-hmm. But they have that elephant rumble, so they can communicate quite large distances at very low frequencies. So it's very difficult to even hear it with the human ear, but you can record it with acoustic monitoring devices.
Yeah. Okay. Did you also record sound or just camera traps?
Yeah, I also recorded sounds, but I didn't use it for this study. The main thing of this study is that we have a huge number of replications. And sound is more of an experimental technique still, and it requires a lot of data storage and other types of analysis. And yeah, as I said, it was already a very ambitious project using all these camera traps. We didn't use the sound for this study in particular.
Mm-hmm. How long were the cameras actually in the forest for before you go back and pick them up again?
Well, between 2 to 3 months. But yeah, we also had the COVID pandemic. And then I wasn't allowed back in the Congo. Well, nobody was allowed to travel. So we had to leave those camera traps for 9 months in the Congo at one of the sites. For all the other sites, it was between 2 to 3 months.
Oh, didn't you fear that they would have been gone, like would have been damaged or lost during that period?
Yeah, well, they were basically written off after that period, so we lost a lot of them, yeah.
So, okay, yeah. Okay. So you weren't able to retrieve many of them compared to the other areas?
Well, we retrieved them, but they were broken. But yeah, the SD cards were still functioning, so we still had the data. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Luckily.
New money again, yeah.
I'm a bit curious about working with the local communities, etc. It sounded like you didn't set up, like you just went into a village, said, who want to work with me? Is that how the setup works?
Depending on the site, because some of the, well, actually FSC certified companies, they really work with local recruiting companies, and then the employees are also insured. In other areas in the Congo Basin, it's less formal. So then people just work on it for day-to-day wages. So then we just went into the village and asked, like, hey, who wants to work with us? Usually there was a lot of enthusiasm because it's of course, a region where it's not very easy to make cash from labor. Yeah, it was always easy to find people.
It sounds like there's a difference. And in the certified areas, it's more organized.
Yeah, definitely. So that was not part of my research, but it's quite clear. So I went to a lot of logging companies and also to their sawmills and things like that. And especially in the sawmills or in the logging teams, you see that in FSC certified companies, they always simply have the safety gear that you would expect, right? Like gloves, proper glasses, things like that. And in some of the other companies that weren't certified, although not all of them, but some of them, we didn't see that kind of gear. I'm not opposed to local hunting at all, right? Because people have been hunting there for centuries or millennia. And I think it's a good thing if people can continue their cultural habits. But of course, the demand from the cities for bushmeat is unsustainable. So if you open up the forest for hunting, and then you get a lot of commercial hunters that trade their meat to the cities, then that's where the problem is. Even in FSC certified concessions, you have sometimes hunting campaigns with local communities so that it's done sustainably. The difference lies in managing that the opening up of the forest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's really the key is really making sure that the roads are closed again after logging. And it's not the hunting in of itself, that's an issue.
Yeah, that's one of the measures indeed, but also providing alternative proteins for the families and the workers. Yeah, well, just checking whether there's hunting gear in vehicles and prohibiting that, things like that. So it's a set of measures, and also having the anti-poaching patrols, of course, for elephants, that's particularly important. Mm-hmm. So for a poacher, you can imagine, You're not going to hunt in an area where you might get caught if there's another large forest where there are no guards at all.
Mm-hmm. I know you studied very much the tropical forest. Do you think that if you looked in other places in the world that the results of a similar study would be the same, or is it unique to that African setting?
I think we can extrapolate our findings to other tropical forests because it's got the same forestry system, selective logging, creation of roads, and then managing those roads and other aspects related to hunting. Well, I can't say anything about other types of forestry. So forestry in boreal forest, for example, has got its own pressures and risks that would require other studies. Yeah.
Mm. I know you actually revealed the first time your studies back in October in 2022 at the FSC General Assembly, and you've only just released and published the study now. What's happened in the interim between that a couple of years ago and now?
Oh, well, a lot of peer review discussions. So if you go to the article in Nature, then if you scroll all the way down, there's a peer review file. It's got 52 pages of discussions that I had. It's public. You can just review it, read it with the peer reviewers. So they wanted me to do a different type of statistical analysis, which we did, but it takes some time. So it took some months because it was quite complex. Same year, I also had a baby, so I wasn't working the whole period. But if you send it back to the peer reviewers, they want to look at it. It takes like another 2 months. They send it back to us. We have to do something with their comments, spend another month or two replying. And well, we did that with 3 iterations. So altogether, it took like 1.5 years to get it published in Nature.
Well, and why is it that Nature is the place to get published?
Well, it's just the highest ranking academic journal that you can publish in. So it's got, as a scientist, we look at impact factors, and it's got an impact factor of 65 or something like that, whereas other journals have an impact factor of 5 to 10. So it's like way higher, and it's the journal that a lot of journalists and the international media look at. So if you really want to have a very large impact, I think we had a story that we really wanted to share with a broad audience because it's relevant to, well, consumers, but also policymakers around the world. Then you want to get it published in Nature. But it's not that easy because I think only 3% of the papers that get submitted there actually get published there. So, yeah.
Was it always your goal to get it in Nature?
I think it's everybody's, every scientist's goal to get something in Nature, but the data, the results, and the article also have to lend itself to that. Because, first of all, it's got to have global relevance. It's globally relevant because we can also apply these findings to tropical forests in the Amazon and in Asia. But the results, yeah, they also have to be very strong, I guess. And we had a very clear, positive story. And I think that's what they liked about it as well.
Mm. And what now? I mean, now you're not that old. You've already been in Nature. What's your next big goal? What are you going to do next? Are you going to continue researching on FSC?
No, I was about to retire, but no. I actually, I'm just a scientist continuing my work, looking at wildlife and tropical forest. I also just got an article accepted about IFLs.
Intact forest landscapes.
Intact forest landscapes, exactly. and FSC's role in it. So we hope to really move that discussion within FSC a bit further with that article. It's certainly interesting to have a look at that in the coming weeks. Yeah, I'm also working on human-elephant conflict because if you have a lot of elephants, there's more conflict with local communities, right? So we're trying to look into that. But I also have other projects in Indonesia looking at the impact of forest fragments on wildlife conservation in oil palm landscapes. Basically, my research focuses on protecting wildlife in tropical forest areas where we produce resources. So I have a lot of different projects.
It sounds both like you're really busy and it sounds really interesting as well. I'm actually curious, just can you then repurpose? You collected a lot of data now. Can you repurpose that into other studies so that you utilize the same data that you already collected once? Or do you have to go back?
It's great that you ask, because I forgot to mention that in my previous comment. Part of my focus, my research focus, is also on improving wildlife monitoring techniques, because if we want to know whether something that we do is effective, whether FSC is effective, we have to effectively monitor the wildlife populations if they go up or down, right? And we can use sound for that, or we can use drones or camera traps, but we want to improve those techniques. And I'm also going to use all the data that we gathered to improve the automated detection of wildlife on camera trap photos for Central African species. So that's something that we're doing right now. But we're also looking using the data for other purposes, looking at ecological studies. So if we detected a certain species, was it then always close to water or always in an open area? And then we can look at those associations to learn more about the ecology of the species in the forest. So certainly, yes, we're using that data for a lot of different studies.
Yeah. Wow. It's really interesting. I can't help but think that AI must also be like the next big thing that you're looking into.
Yeah, so together with the other authors, I was just a data contributor there, but there's another article where we developed an algorithm to look at camera trap images already. That's pretty nice. It's also available in an offline desktop portal for park managers and logging concession holders in Central Africa, and it's being used. Well, it's still limited in its scope, right? You can detect elephants and leopards and very, distinct species, but you can't detect one duiker from another forest antelope. And that was necessary for my study because we really wanted to know like which weight classes and which species were benefiting from FSC certified forestry to really understand what was happening. So we really needed to look at them manually. But for some studies, if you want to look just at elephants, then yeah, I could say that's already automated. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I guess if you look just a couple of years ahead, I bet you that it would be able to analyze it for you.
Yeah, it just depends on the training data. So we need to gather more photos and annotate them manually and then train those algorithms with better techniques. And they're evolving very quickly. I totally agree with that.
So now you just have to get back into the forest.
Yeah.
Would you do it again tomorrow? And what's the biggest learning from spending that much time in the forest?
Spending time in the forest is great, but we shouldn't over-romanticize it because it's also very hard. Well, I spend endless time in the forest with very many people. The 260 local employees that joined me. And I learned a lot from them and from listening to the forest. You hear all the crazy sounds and every day you see something new. But there's just so much biodiversity to conserve and it's just amazing to be there. Yeah, I would always love to go back, but I'm not sure if I want to do another 4-year, 5-year round of field work.
What was the worst thing and the best thing about being in forest for such a long time?
The worst thing were the bees. and the best thing was listening to the forest at night after hard days of walking and just being there, maybe sitting next to the campfire with the guys. Yeah, that was amazing.
Now all of this research is out into the world. What do you hope that the world uses it for? What do you hope the impact is of all of that and during all of those many hikes in the forest?
Of course, for consumers, policymakers, NGOs, companies, we provide the knowledge to really safely say, okay, I can choose for this label for FSC certified forestry or any similarly stringent scheme, but we didn't test that. And then we can say, this choosing for a forest full of wildlife versus choosing for a forest that might be devoid of that wildlife. So that's an easy choice. And before, it was always uncertain whether there really was that impact. And then, of course, we hope that this also influences policies. So maybe from consumer countries, but also from producer countries. In producer countries, people can also decide to just go for FSC certification, for example, to protect the wildlife in their forest while still having the economic advantage of the logging industry.
Mm-hmm. That wouldn't be a bad outcome, I would say.
No, indeed. And I think it's the only logical outcome, right? Because we're living in a globalized world and we just use resources from all across the planet. And we have to find ways to produce those resources sustainably because we need them. And we cannot just ignore the reality. We have to produce resources. But we also have to find ways to not harm the rest of the ecosystem to conserve the biodiversity that we have.
That concludes my conversation with Yuri, and I have to say that I'm blown away, just like my colleagues were, and that I'm incredibly proud of getting to work for an organization which strives to have that kind of positive impact on our planet. I really do hope that Yuri's long-term hopes for impact of his research becomes true. That this kind of proof of the impact of FSC not only means that consumers are going to start looking for FSC with more intent, because they know that it means that biodiversity is thriving in the place where their product comes from, but that it also has an impact on the concession owners and governments who will see the potential effect of FSC. 2.7 times more wildlife, and will seek FSC certification to ensure that even more areas of tropical forests are protected in the future. Thank you, Yuri, for taking the time to speak to me before heading off to Africa again. I promised him that I would give a shout out to all researchers out there who might be listening to the podcast and tell them to get in touch if they had interesting research topics related to forests and biodiversity. So, if that is you, please do reach out to Yuri. And to the rest of you, thank you in advance to each of you for making a conscious choice to seek out FSC certified products as often as possible, whether in your private lives or in your professional roles. You now know even more what an impact it can have. Remember to subscribe to Forest of the Future if you want to get notified of new episodes where we dive into other innovations within FSC and the world of certification and sustainable forest management. You can always get in touch with me as well on podcast@fsc.org. I am Laura Wurm, and this was Forest for the Future.